Today on the 21st, we start the week, as always, with our reporter roundtable, looking at the latest with COVID-19. Illinois is on pace to enter the next phase of eased restrictions later this week. Then, last week, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 against the Trump administration's attempt to end Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, known as the DACA program, started under the Obama administration. We'll look into what this means for the 34,000 active DACA recipients in Illinois and for the future of the program. Then the coronavirus pandemic has disrupted food distribution systems, and that's just one of the reasons some Illinoisans have turned to growing their own. I'm Brian Mackey, the new Victory Gardens and more all coming up this hour on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Monday morning, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker says the state is on pace to move into the next phase of easing COVID-19 restrictions this Friday. That would mean gatherings of up to 50 people, up from the current limit of 10. It would also mean indoor dining at restaurants, albeit at 25% of capacity. Plus, movie theaters, museums, sporting events all could resume, though with significantly reduced capacity. Meanwhile, COVID-19 infections are still happening. Officials announced nearly 1,300 newly confirmed cases in Illinois over the weekend, with another 67 deaths. Joining us to talk about this on our Monday Reporters Roundtable are Kara Anthony. She's a reporter with Kaiser Health News. Kara, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Lee Gaines, a reporter at Illinois Newsroom and WILL. Lee, thank you for being here again.
Happy to be here.
And Kristen Schorsch, she's a government and politics reporter at WBEZ. She has also been covering COVID-19 in a number of different ways. Kristen, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Kara, I'm going to begin with you and ask, what are you seeing in your region, in Metro East, in terms of the COVID-19 pandemic? I mean, are businesses are reopening, I gather, but are people taking it seriously still, or do a lot of people seem to be kind of over it, as we've seen in some places?
You know what, Ryan? I would definitely say that it's a good mix. I was just out and about over the weekend milling around, and I definitely, it seemed like I saw half and half in some places. People were wearing masks, and in other places, you know, folks just chose to go without. But even in Southern Illinois, we had a surge over the weekend with more cases being reported. It was particularly interesting to see over the Father's Day weekend all of the patio seating out at different restaurants, because on Friday, Illinois will allow dine-in seating for folks that want to sit down in a restaurant and eat. So after months of not being able to do that and sitting outside for the last few weeks, they'll be able to do that now in Illinois. But really a good mix, but a lot of folks definitely were out this weekend for sure.
And Lee, you're in Champaign-Urbana. I wonder what you're seeing on the ground there.
Well, in Champaign-Urbana, I'm seeing a lot of mask compliance. So it would be shocking to me, and it is shocking to me anytime I go to a grocery store or convenience store and see someone without a mask. It's usually one person out of dozens who are wearing masks. So everyone is really, it still appears to be taking it seriously. The same goes for the protests that have been happening. I've been seeing a lot of people wearing masks at those as well. Interestingly, I did the weekend before last take a road trip to a cabin in Southern Indiana, and I ended up stopping at some gas stations in Southern Central Illinois. So East Central Illinois, but sort of towards the Indiana border. And I saw a lot less compliance. There were frequently times where I was the only person wearing a mask in the convenience store. And the same is true actually for Southern Indiana as well. So that was actually quite interesting and sort of shocking for me to see, especially coming from Champaign-Urbana, where the compliance is really high.
Interesting. Yeah. Here, I mean, in Springfield, where I'm based, there, it's definitely not shocking to see people without masks anymore. The compliance has been slipping for a while. And we are also here on the 21st doing a texting initiative, and I just wanted to pause for a moment. It's called Text the 21st. We asked our texting group 2 weeks ago, with Illinois in phase three of reopening, what, level of normal activities people are resuming, how they're keeping themselves safe. We got a response from Lauren in Urbana who said, quote, "I'm still working from home and avoiding stores, personal services, seeing friends, etc. If I do see friends or expect to be among crowds, I wear a mask, stay outside, and stay apart." We also got a message from Jim in Urbana who said, quote, "We're still being quite cautious due to health complications, which would not do well in combo with COVID-19. If we need to go out, we wear protective gear, mask always, gloves sometimes. It's a very small price to pay for us and those we come in contact with." End quote. And listeners, if you want to join our texting group, you can text the word talk to 217-803-0730. That's talk to 217-803-0730. Kristen Schorsch from WBEZ, I want to bring you into the conversation. Chicago, of course, has been at the center of the hardest hit region in Illinois. And I wonder how are things looking there in terms of, how people are responding to the pandemic here as we're coming to the end of June.
Yeah, things are looking good here. You consider all these metrics that public health officials use to determine how quickly we reopen more of the economy. And in Chicago, the number of COVID cases continues to decline. This big metric, known as the positivity rate, this is the percentage of people who test positive for COVID, it's around 5% right now. And the goal to move forward was to have this rate be less than 7%. So this Friday, the city is actually scheduled to open even more of the economy. We're going into phase four, and where we have a five-phase plan, right? So people can, like you mentioned at the top of the show, they can eat inside again, they can go to zoos, museums, groups of 50 people can meet indoors, 100 people outside, still with limitations on capacity. And people are still encouraged to wear those masks, to stay 6 feet apart from one another, to keep that social distance. But yeah, things are looking good.
It's interesting. In Chicago, I understand the Lakefront Trail reopened today, and I think in many other parts of Illinois, parks, not necessarily playgrounds, but parks where people could go running or walking have been open for a while now. Why was that closed, and what are the new rules there?
Yeah, so back in March when the pandemic really picked up here, the lakefront in Chicago is like this really popular destination. Bikers, walkers, people growing out in the green space between the trails, on the beaches. But you still had these hordes and groups of people gathering. And so, the mayor was like, this could really help spread COVID. So she shut it down. So, we've been, what, 3 months or so without legally being allowed to use the beaches or the paths. And so today, the Lakefront Trail reopened. So this is just the trail. This is just like the path you can bike on, you walk on, you have to keep it moving. It's still just for exercise and transit only. The beaches are still closed, but still, this is a big deal for people. I live on the north side of the city. I live behind a bunch of trails. It's usually pretty empty down in my backyard. And when the lakefront closed, everybody came to all these other parts of the city, including to these trails, and now they're empty again. So yeah, this is a big step forward for people. People are really excited about this.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. That's Kristen Schorsch, government and politics reporter at WBEZ. We're also speaking with Lee Gaines, who's a reporter at Illinois Newsroom from WILL, and Kara Anthony, who's a reporter with Kaiser Health News. Kara, given that people in the Metro East region of Illinois are really part of the broader St. Louis metropolitan area, I think it is worth paying attention to a little bit what's happening in Missouri. Can you tell us anything about the cases on the other side of the Mississippi River?
Yeah, Missouri experienced a record-breaking surge just over the weekend. There were 413 new cases reported, and that was on Sunday. And so just the day before that, though, another record was broken with 389 new cases reported. So lots of new cases happening, but you have to remember that Missouri, certain parts of it, St. Louis County, didn't, and parts of St. Louis City didn't reopen right away. But we all remember watching the video from the Ozarks happening early on. And so Now we are experiencing a surge here in the state where things reopened quickly outside of the major metropolitan area. But now St. Louis City is also starting to reopen, and really they are moving forward pretty quickly in wanting to, you know, have things go back to normal as safely as possible. So,
yeah, interesting. You know, Kristen, it strikes me that Chicago, I think, as you said, they're on pace to sort of join Illinois with, you know, on Friday of this week, June 26th, in terms of moving to the next phase. But it had been delayed in coming into the current phase, phase three. I wonder if you can talk about what was behind that delay and also, you know, what could keep Chicago from moving forward? I know you've done some reporting on that.
Yeah, so the reason for that delay was because Chicago basically has stricter guidelines than the state. They're more specific in a lot of cases for when it would move forward. So it makes it harder for the city to move forward. So, for example, that positivity rate I mentioned, that percentage of people testing positive for COVID, the state reopens more of the economy when that rate is at or below 20%. And Chicago, you know, to get into phase four, they made it below 7%. So that's a lot harder to get to, right? Also, there are other things like, you know, the city of Chicago wants to have, you know, at least 5% of residents a month tested. So like more than 4,500 tests a day for Chicago residents. And the state, you know, their guideline is we want to test all available patients, healthcare workers, first respondents. So basically the city is just more specific and makes it harder to move forward. In terms of what could push us back or, you know, move forward into the next phase, what could push us back is the key thing is that public health officials are very concerned about our hospitals getting overwhelmed with patients. They have caps on things like the number of ICU beds and ventilators available for patients. You know, we hit those limits. That's a real danger for treating COVID patients and other people who need to be in the hospital, right, for other reasons. So hospitals only have so much space. We hit those limits. We basically could move back. That's the bottom line, is wanting to make sure the hospitals don't get overwhelmed.
Interesting. So I want to shift gears a little bit. Lee, last week you were reporting on the University of Illinois' plans for resuming on-campus instruction this fall. And a big part of that, I understand, is a new coronavirus test being developed on the Urbana campus. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so it's a saliva-based COVID-19 test that was developed here by faculty and research students. And what basically they're saying they'll be able to do is that they'll be able to test up to 10,000 people per day and also get same day results. And so it's not the nasopharyngeal swab that I think some people might be familiar with or more used to.
The brain scrape, as it's
Yeah,
known.
The brain scrape. It's using someone's saliva. So I think it was described to folks who were on a webinar recently that it would be like, you know, part of the orientation for the students who are coming back to school this fall would be submitting a saliva sample and getting tested for COVID-19 along with, you know, getting their university ID card and all the things that you do when you come back to campus or you come to a campus for the first time. Interestingly, they also plan to retest students and staff at the university. So, you know, that they're using an algorithm that they developed. They're also adding COVID-19 features to an app, an Illinois app is what it's called. And that will essentially alert students and staff that they need to get tested again for COVID-19 periodically. And the algorithm, as it's been described, will weigh certain risk factors to determine whether or not someone needs to get tested. In addition to that, they've also developed a feature as part of this app where students and staff can opt into this, which will alert you if you have come into contact or close contact with someone who has tested positive for COVID-19. So the other user would also have had to opt into that feature. There are some concerns with the app that were expressed by staff working on it, like privacy is a huge concern.
Mm-hmm.
And the university is essentially telling folks, look, we're not Google, we're not Facebook, we're not going to sell your data. We're just trying to keep people safe.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and I want to shift gears again, because another big story that we've been following on the 21st this month relates to the protests against police brutality and racism. And Kara Anthony with Kaiser Health News, I know this is another public health crisis of a sort, and I know you've been following this closely. Your most recent story is called Just Make It Home, The Unwritten Rules Blacks Learn to Navigate Racism in America. And I want to encourage our listeners to read it. We'll tweet out a link to the story at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. And Kara, obviously we can't do justice to that story in this short conversation in the minute and a half we have remaining, but can you just talk a little bit about your reporting there and the mental health toll of living with these unwritten rules?
Yeah, in this story, readers get to meet a mental health caseworker by the name of Darnell Hill. He works particularly in the north part of St. Louis City, where he's teaching young teenagers how to physically assimilate anytime they go into a white space or have an encounter with a police officer. And when I say physically assimilate, I mean he's teaching them how to watch their body language when they're going into a business, how to walk through a park, just how to exist in spaces where they should feel comfortable and have a right to feel comfortable. But over time, it's just not that way. And so this physical code switching, I guess you could say, he's run down a list of what he calls living while Black. And he's teaching this to teenagers. And even though he hopes that it will work, it really doesn't guarantee a win, because a conversation has to be had on the other side. You know, while Black Americans are learning how to code switch and physically maybe try to appear to be non-threatening, you know, I think it's important to note in the article notes that white Americans really need to have conversations about anti-racism with their children at an early age, because these talks started with kids as young as 5 years old.
Wow. All right. Kara Anthony is a reporter with Kaiser Health News. Again, we will tweet out a link to that story and the stories from our other reporters at 21ST Show. We've also been speaking with Lee Gaines, who's a reporter with Illinois Newsroom and WILL, and Kristen Schorsch, government and politics reporter at WBEZ. Kara, Lee, Kristen, thank you so much for joining us this Monday morning.
Thank you.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Coming up after a short break, we're going to be talking about last week's DACA decision, about the so-called Dreamers and the 34,000 of them here in Illinois. What's next for them? This is the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Late last week, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the DACA program, known as the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This was started under the Obama administration. The Trump administration was trying to rescind it. There are an estimated 650,000 DACA recipients, also known as Dreamers, who are in the program, 34,000 active recipients right here in Illinois. And now, after the U.S. Supreme Court's 5-4 decision last week against the Trump administration's challenges to the program, those so-called Dreamers are safe, at least for now. We'll dig into the Supreme Court's historic decision and what it means for Dreamers now, as well as the future of the program. Joining us now are Lauren Aronson, Immigration Law Clinic Director at the University of Illinois College of Law, Lawrence Benito, Chief Executive Officer of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, and Carlos Benitez. He's a DACA recipient and student at Dominican University, where he's also president of the Undocumented and Immigrant Alliance. Lauren, Lawrence, and Carlos, thank you for joining us on the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And listeners, we invite you to join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. The number is 800-222-9455. We want to hear your thoughts on the Supreme Court's decision on DACA, or maybe you or someone you know is a DACA recipient. What's your reaction? Maybe you have a question on DACA and what the Supreme Court's decision means. 800-222-9455. That number again is 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. Lauren, I want to begin with you and sort of get into exactly what the Supreme Court's decision said. The majority opinion written by Chief Justice John Roberts called the Trump administration's decision to rescind DACA arbitrary and capricious. What is that referring to?
Right. So that's referring to specifically administrative law, not anything to do with the substance of deferred action for childhood arrivals or anything really to do with immigration law. And so basically, in saying that the decision was arbitrary and capricious, Justice Roberts was saying that the government acted, but without, one, considering reliance of DACA recipients and potential DACA applicants, and that includes, you know, the reliance on their ability to stay safely in the United States for 2 years and to work, as many DACA recipients are able to do, as well as by failing to provide satisfactory reasoning for the decision to end DACA.
So what I hear from you is this is not necessarily like a decision on human rights. This is a decision on sloppiness of administrative procedure in handling the paperwork or something involved in what the Trump administration was trying to do.
Yes, that's exactly right. In fact, Justice Roberts says, you know, we are not making a decision about whether or not the DACA rescission was a sound policy. We're also not making a decision on whether DACA was legal in the first place. We're only making a decision about the ability of the court to review the government's act to end DACA.
So it seems possible then that the Trump administration or some other administration could, in a way that was not arbitrary and capricious, attempt to do the same thing, and presumably that would trigger off a new round of court fights. I mean, is that an accurate read? Go ahead.
That's exactly right. The Trump administration has already said that's the plan, right? Yeah. We're okay, fine. We didn't do it right. We're doing it right the next time. Although, of course, they're not acknowledging they didn't do it right, but they're saying, okay, you're saying we didn't do it right. So now we're going to do it again. We're going to get rid of DACA. And so while it is a victory, it's not a, you know, oh, great, relief, we can breathe. It's a momentary time of celebration and hope. And then, you know, we have to be prepared for exactly what you said, which is the next round of litigation.
Okay. So I want to bring Lawrence Benito into the conversation here. As the CEO of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, your organization works with DACA recipients, also known as Dreamers, for the DREAM Act, which would make this permanent law as opposed to sort of an administrative action. And I wonder if you can just back up a little bit and talk about how the program started in 2012 under the Obama administration, who it's designed for, and what protections it offered.
Well, I just want to acknowledge this DACA would not have happened had it not been for courageous, directly impacted individuals fighting and pushing the administration to do the right thing. People speaking in the first person saying, I'm directly impacted by this issue and you need to do something that was directly related to the creation of the program. But you have oftentimes kids brought here at a young age. This is the only country that they know. For the current president, when he took office and campaigned on the issue, that he was going to build the wall and, you know, push for unprecedented numbers of people being deported, we knew exactly what his play was going to be. In an election year, we anticipate that he's going to try to, you know, make some moves again. But I think what the Supreme Court ruled and demonstrated was that, you know, what the Trump administration tried to do was un-American, unlawful, and just simply wrong.
What advice or guidance has your organization been giving DACA recipients in light of the Supreme Court's decision?
Well, we're encouraging folks who are eligible to continue to apply. And we've told them, you know, to be involved because the only permanent solution is something that only Congress can provide, and the makeup of Congress and the makeup of who's in the White House matters. And so in an election year, we're encouraging people to get involved. If you're eligible to vote, register to vote, and work with us towards November.
And if you're just joining us, we're discussing the U.S. Supreme Court's recent 5-4 decision to reject the Trump administration's attempt to end the DACA or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals programs. Our guests are Lauren Aronson, Immigration Law Clinic Director at the University of Illinois College of Law, Lawrence Benito, CEO of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, and Carlos Benitez, a DACA recipient and student at Dominican University, where he's also president of the Undocumented and Immigrant Alliance. If you want to join the conversation or have a question for one of our guests, give us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Carlos, I want to bring you in here. You, as I've just said, you're a DACA recipient, student at Dominican University in River Forest, which is a suburb of Chicago. I wonder if you can talk about what the DACA program has meant for you, first of all, and second, what has your experience been like as a DACA recipient, being in limbo, having to wait on this decision by the Supreme Court that could have significant consequences for you?
Yeah. You know, first, thank you for having me on the show. I remember the first time that we got wind of DACA, and my older sister, who was 18 at the time, she received DACA, and my mom asked her when she got it, how do you feel? And I remember my sister saying, I feel like I exist. And that is, you know, just retched in my memory so much, because I remember DACA being finally this this sign, right, of that us as undocumented immigrants were worthy to be here, and that we deserved humanity, and that we deserved a chance of being here. And I've had experiences not having DACA and having DACA, and honestly, it does change the way employers treat you. It changes the way people treat you. And for me, DACA has allowed me to measure my own self-worth and to push, right, for what I deserve, because I am a person, I'm intelligent, I am valuable, and my peers are too. And DACA has given me the ability to pick up my voice and raise the voice of others.
And I wonder, what was your reaction when you heard the news of the Supreme Court's decision last week?
I think for a lot of us, it was a happy day, though we know it's very momentary. It's very momentary. And, you know, I'm happy that we are aware of that. It gives us some breathing room, and we can use that breathing room to prepare. Right. Before this decision, there was always a lot of running, right? Running for the next moment, preparing for the next moment, you know, creating contingency plans within the Undocumented Student Alliance and within the university. I'm part of a couple policymaking groups here, making sure that we were prepared to support our undocumented students. This gives us a chance to just have a couple of months, right, to prepare for the incoming undocumented class and prepare to help more undocumented students.
Hmm. So, Lawrence Benito, President Obama's memo, which created the DACA program, called it a temporary stopgap measure. It does not offer, you know, so-called amnesty or immunity or a path to citizenship. I wonder how important is action by Congress to the future of the people who are affected by this program, and what are you hoping for there?
Well, I think you just heard from Carlos, and the awareness of, you know, what he said and what we've heard from many people with DACA, they know that this is a momentary protection, right? But can be taken away, and the Trump administration tried to do it. They just didn't do it the right way. And so we expect that they'll be turning in the paperwork, right, to try to end it. And so we need to fight for Congress to make a permanent solution, a permanent fix to provide relief for these folks and their families who call this country home. And what we've seen poll after poll, Republicans, Democrats, the vast majority of Americans support this legislation to protect these undocumented, well, they were youth. They're no longer. Some of them have now started their own families because, you know, it has taken Congress this long to deal with this issue. So we're going to push them. And the, you know, the time is now. And, you know, we believe that if put before the American people, poll after poll has showed that the vast majority of Americans would support it.
And Lauren, we got a call from Chuck in Morton, Illinois. He's no longer on the line. He asked us to paraphrase his question. But he wanted to know if parents are not, if they don't have legal citizenship status, would they have to, you know, go back to their country of origin under what the law is now? And if so, what would happen to their children in that case?
Yes. So parents with no lawful status, should DACA be effectively rescinded, would have no forbearance of removal, which means that the government could initiate those removal proceedings against them and send them back. And the question of whether their U.S. citizen children would go with them or not is, you know, it would be a personal decision for that family. Some families would choose unity and would choose to take those United States citizens from the country and move back to the parents' original home country. Some would have those children stay with families, family members or friends, or, you know, just find some other way to do it. But inevitably, those children are United States citizens. They have the rights that each one of us has, and they should have access to all of the benefits that citizenship bestows upon them. So it's likely that there would be family separation that would occur should that happen. And I just wanted to underscore what Lawrence said in the sense that we do need legislation on this. And regardless of the outcome of the 2020 election, I do think that legislation is possible. And there was, you know, a recent act that was proposed just a year ago in May of 2019, but passed by the House in June of 2019, that would make this law. And it would allow for current DACA recipients, and actually more than those, because it would expand upon that, to have a pathway to citizenship, so they would no longer have to worry that at any moment, you know, the rug would be pulled out from under them, and they would have to make decisions about separating their family and returning to their country, or, you know, going undercover and living in this country unlawfully.
And this is such an important conversation. We've only got a couple of minutes left in this segment. I'd like, if you all can, we're just going to hold on and carry this over into the next segment. But we've got about a minute and a half left before we need to take a break. And so, Lauren, I just want to ask you briefly, since, you know, we are sort of talking about the sort of policy aspect here. In the midst of these ongoing challenges from the Trump administration to DACA, there was a hold on new applicants to the program. Can new applicants apply now in light of the Supreme Court's decision? And you know, what are the rules and policies there?
So legally, under this decision by the Supreme Court, yes, new applicants could apply. However, practically, it's going to take some time before they will be able to submit those applications. Just as it took time to sort of wind down the DACA program, it will take time to wind it back up. And so until USCIS, the entity that adjudicates these applications, gets the processes in place for actually accepting and reviewing new applications as opposed to just the renewals, new DACA applicants will not be able to apply, but they should get ready to in the event that they can.
And in about 20, 30 seconds, Lawrence Benito, have you seen a wave of people interested in applying in the last few days since the Supreme Court's decision?
We have received a number of calls with people asking us, can I come forward and apply? And as Lauren stated, our understanding of the ruling is that they should. There is a practical consideration, but we are encouraging people, you know, who are eligible to apply.
Okay, I want to continue this conversation after the break. That's Lawrence Benito, CEO of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. We've also been speaking with Lauren Aronson, who's a Immigration Law Clinic Director at the University of Illinois College of Law, and Carlos Benitez, who's a DACA recipient and student at Dominican University, also president of the Undocumented and Immigrant Alliance there. More to come on this important conversation after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we have been talking about the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court decision last week on the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or the DACA program. It was started under the Obama administration. The Trump administration has been attempting to rescind it. There are about 650,000 DACA recipients, also known as Dreamers, across the country, 34,000 active recipients said to be here in Illinois. We've been speaking with Lauren Aronson, who's Immigration Law Clinic Director at the University of Illinois College of Law, Lawrence Benito, CEO of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, and Carlos Benitez, who's a DACA recipient, student at Dominican University, and president of the Undocumented and Immigrant Alliance there. And Carlos, I wanted to ask you, as a DACA recipient and president of that group at Dominican University, I wonder, what are you sensing and hearing from fellow DACA recipients? How are they feeling about this decision, and as we come up on an important election this fall?
I know there's a lot of movement from undocumented students. I think right now, especially with this generation of undocumented students, which comes right after the Dreamers, right? I think we are in a different consciousness when we know we can be politically engaged, and we have to be because we have a lot at stake, right? So we are mobilizing to make sure that our campus is helping the students who can vote to make sure that they vote, that they register, and that they're informed about local elections as well as the federal elections, just to make sure that, you know, our voices are heard and that our peers, right, our peers who care about us and our peers who love us do keep us in mind as they're voting.
Do you ever hear, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. As for the SCOTUS election, as the SCOTUS decision, there is a lot of hope, right? And within the undocumented students, there is a lot of hope. However, as it's been mentioned, right now, we need to be cautious. We need to be cautious of that hope. And we need to be alert and aware that this is momentary, that the SCOTUS decision was about process, right? And so Trump can do this again in a different way. And so we are prepared for that. We are procuring funds to help fund DACA renewals. We are doing our best to make sure that we support undocumented students.
Okay. And I think we're going to leave the conversation there. That is Carlos Benitez. He's a DACA recipient and student at Dominican University, also president of the Undocumented and Immigrant Alliance there. We also spoke with Lawrence Benito, CEO of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, and Lauren Aronson, Immigration Law Clinic Director at the University of Illinois College of Law. Carlos, Lawrence, and Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us here on the 21st.
Thanks so much for covering this important issue.
Thank you.
During both world wars, as more food was being rationed for the war effort, the federal government encouraged people to grow their own food and provided lots of resources on just how to do so. Victory gardens, as they were known, popped up in whatever spaces people could find, on rooftops and balconies, empty lots, backyards. There was an emphasis on self-sufficiency, community, and contributing to collective victory, hence the name Victory Gardens. Today, the coronavirus has affected food distribution networks across the country and changed the way many of us get our food. And with business closures and stay-at-home orders, many people are finding themselves with more time at home. Those are among the reasons some people have once again turned to growing their own fruits and vegetables. Tracy Barkley is with us now. She's the director of Sola Gratia Farms in Urbana. Sola Gratia has also partnered with the Cunningham Township for their new community garden program, Solidarity Gardens. Tracy, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks so much. Good morning.
Good morning. And also with me is Heather Edwards, Associate Director of DeKalb County Community Gardens. Heather, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And if you've started maybe a garden of your own for the first time this year, or if you even have a gardening question for an expert, you can always join our conversation by giving us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Tracy, I want to begin with you. How did the pandemic and resulting stay-at-home order change things for Sola Gratia Farms? Has this spring and summer looked different for your organization?
Boy, it sure has. Every spring brings its challenges, but I think what we saw right away is that folks were really concerned about where their food was going to be coming from and had discomfort, of course, going to the grocery store and generally out into the public. So we operate a CSA program, which is a vegetable subscription service. We normally sell out in April, maybe May, and we were sold out by, the end of March, early April, as more people were really trying to think ahead and secure their vegetables for the season. We also, we needed to keep growing. Our season starts really in the wintertime when we start making plans, ordering seeds, prepping the beds. And so we've been at work this entire time, but we've had to suspend our volunteer program, and our staff has had to work under some difficult conditions considering distancing and wearing masks.
Yeah. So Heather Edwards from DeKalb County Community Gardens is with us as well. Heather, have you noticed more people using the gardens this year?
Yes, we definitely have had more people using the gardens. A couple of our locations, I know that all of the gardens are rented out. So there's definitely been an increase. Just like Tracy was saying, a lot of people are kind of concerned with the food chain and wanting to, make sure that they have something to eat.
And how does that work? Can anyone get a plot through the community gardens in DeKalb County?
Yes, correct. They can contact us, and then we send them a form that they can fill out. And then we have a location in Sycamore, in DeKalb, and also in Genoa.
And have you had to make any adjustments on account of the increased demand?
Well, we haven't, other than, a lot of the spots that, we have no more plots to rent. Unfortunately, we are having to tell some people, that there's no availability. We still have some availability, though, in our Genoa location.
Tracy, I wonder if you think that some of the consequences of the pandemic, namely, there was a period where people were seeing empty store shelves. We were hearing about outbreaks in meat processing plants, other disruptions to food distribution. I wonder if you think that led people to think more about where their food is coming from.
Absolutely. I think it has really shown us how important supporting local agriculture program is, and knowing your farmer and working with smaller operations that can be a little bit more nimble in times like this. I think this is really shown us where some of our weaknesses are and how, when you have more links in the chain, that's just that many more possible disruptions. So I think we've seen a lot more people interested in markets and online ordering and supporting local farms, getting in touch with their bread bakers. So in some ways, it's a revival of local agriculture. And also, I think there are a lot of people that are kind of dusting off their tools and remembering, hey, I can grow fruit for myself as well.
Yeah. And speaking of that dusting off tools, Heather, a few minutes ago, I mentioned the idea of victory gardens, right? During both world wars. And by 1944, an estimated 20 million victory gardens were producing more than 40% of all fresh fruits and vegetables consumed in America at the time. Heather, do you think that spirit of self-sufficiency and community is experiencing a resurgence today? Or is this, just more a factor of people with time on their hands and, looking for a hobby during the stay-at-home orders?
Oh, definitely. I think there's, been a huge increase. Definitely this spring, we do retail sales with vegetable plants, and we save our extra plants in case we need them. And I mean, this year we were back there planting up all of those items because people kept coming in. And, you know, last year the sales weren't quite as good, I think, because of all the heavy rain. But this year it was like we just couldn't keep up with the demand.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking with Heather Edwards, Associate Director of the DeKalb County Community Gardens, and Tracy Barkley. She's Director of Sola Gratia Farms and CSA in Urbana. We've been hearing more about some of the programs for people looking to grow their own food during the pandemic. As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a question for our gardening experts, give us a call, 800-222-9455. Maybe you've started your own garden. Tweet us a photo of it at 21ST Show. That's 21st Show. Tracy, Sola Gratia has partnered with Cunningham Township for their new Solidarity Gardens programs. How does that work, and what made you want to get involved with that?
So I couldn't be more excited about what's going on in our community right now. I think part of it was just really paying attention to what was already happening. I think as soon as we had some of the early spring temperatures, we started seeing people, you know, put seeds in the ground and plants in the ground and dig up some turf. And the natural response was for people to, you know, and there's availability of time, but also I think, you know, people were starting to already realize, you know, I should be growing a little more food for myself. The other part is that we have a high food insecurity rate in our community, unfortunately. We have 1 in 6 people who don't know where the next meal is coming from. And of course, that's gotten worse with the pandemic. So a number of groups that already work together in community gardening and social services efforts started talking about, you know, how can we support folks and the instincts to help our neighbors and get more food production in our community. Cunningham Township and our Cunningham supervisor, Daniel Chinwith, really took the lead in bringing together our farm, Urbana Free Library, who was on the verge of already starting a seed library this spring. Urbana Parks District, Channing Murray Foundation, you know, a number of partners who are already serving our community to pull together this really community-wide initiative to help people grow food for themselves, their neighbors, and their communities. And we have been working really hard over the last couple of weeks to put together a really robust website where people can come and bring something to table or take something away. It's kind of an advanced matchmaking service for people that have tools or have expertise or already growing and would like to be donating more food in the community, and then also those that are just gardening for the first time or would like to be container gardening. We're offering seeds and tools and plants and expertise to get more people growing food, both for themselves and also for our neighbors in our community.
And Heather, I understand that food insecurity is something that DeKalb County Community Gardens has been working on as well.
That is correct, yes. We have our growmobile that goes throughout DeKalb County, and we have seen a huge increase with that since COVID-19 hit. We've doubled and tripled in some cases people attending the growmobile. So we have a lot more need in the community, as Tracy was saying, and you know, we're hoping that some of these people that are having these gardens will donate some of their fresh produce to our organization once it starts coming in.
And I understand we have a caller on the line. Sarah, welcome to the 21st. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for having me. So I'm from University of Illinois Extension and have been doing a little research on Victory Gardens and was hoping to supplement what your other guests have already knowledgeably added, but just with the social distancing efforts that keep us from leaving our home except for essential items, we have that. We have still very widespread food insecurity everywhere. A lot of households are, you know, maybe single or no income due to unemployment or underemployment. And in addition to that, sometimes we see fresh foods, nutritious foods, can often be more costly than less healthy or processed options. So this is clearly a great time to start a garden, even on a small scale. You know, sometimes for we who do garden already, it's heartbreaking to see on one end of the news report millions of ears of corn going to waste. And on the other end of the news report, we see people lining up for food. Mm-hmm. And so this should really tell us something about our supply chain and what we can do to improve that with growing and buying locally.
Sure.
And as you mentioned, 40% of produce was grown in backyards, mm-hmm. you know, just 75 years ago. And
yep.
so we've seen a few generations, gardening has kind of skipped a few generations, and
right.
people have become kind of reliant upon buying food. And we don't realize sometimes where it comes from or that you can grow it yourself. So let this be our opportunity to teach
yep.
and help each other.
All right. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for the call. Tracy, just in about one or two sentences, what is your final pitch for supporting community agriculture?
Boy, I would say attend your market, your farmers markets. There's a lot of good produce there, bread, eggs, meat. There's a lot there.
Okay.
There's still a number of farms that have CSAs, and I would get on solidarygardencu.org and find out how you can get involved with
All right.
this initiative.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Tracy Barkley is director of Sola Gratia Farm and CSA in Urbana. We also have been speaking with Heather Edwards, associate director of the DeKalb County Community Gardens. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you again tomorrow.